in the federal government, there is a great deal that is happening. This glass is much more than half full, and you're going to hear four examples today that will prove that to you. I also want to make a special comment about our last speaker, Rod Turk, who's joined us filling in for John Owens, who was supposed to be here from Patent and Trademark Office. He is the Director of IT Security Management Group and Chief Information Security Officer for Patent and Trademark. I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but I'll say something about PTO. One of the questions in Max's session referenced Patent and Trademark, saying something like, you know, we always hear about Patent and Trademark and how well they're doing. And my thought was, yes, and there's a reason for it. In fact, all four agencies you'll hear from today are doing extraordinary work. And who should we learn from but from the best in class? And we have four examples here. And we'll begin with Gene Troxell, who I can tell you more about when I get my glasses. Gene has served as Loudoun County, Virginia's Government Director of Information Technology since 1989. Before that, he served in a similar capacity with Loudoun County Public Schools, where he first worked as a high school teacher teaching
Business subjects,
there you go. Moved up to assistant principal at a high school, a central office supervisor, and ultimately director of computer services. Gene earned his bachelor's degree in accounting from Fairleigh Dickinson University and a master's degree in business administration from GW. He's been a governor-appointed member to the state advisory committees and currently active in multiple state and regional organizations, including the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments Chief Information Officers Committee. Gene is currently past president of the Virginia Association of Local Government Information Technology Executives and has been recognized by Computer World as one of Business World's premier 100 information technology leaders. His department is responsible for the operation and support of over 100 information systems used throughout the departments and agencies of the Loudoun County government and public schools. His additional responsibilities include network management, video services, telecommunications, and management of the county's public safety radio communications systems. In 2008, the Center for Digital Government and National Association of Counties ranked Loudoun County number one in its population category in their annual Digital Counties Survey. Please welcome Gene Troxell.
Thank you, Gil. It struck me when I looked at the list of panelists up here that I was kind of the odd man out. I'm the local government guy. How many local government people are here? Is there any? Hey, okay, we got one. All right. Well, we'll hang in there together. We may be outnumbered, but we won't be outgunned, all right? For those of you who don't know where Loudoun County is, Loudoun County is is west of the District of Columbia. Matter of fact, it's 25 miles west of the District of Columbia is the county line. It is the county with Dulles Airport in it. If you've been flying through, that's Dulles, even though Fairfax likes to claim it. A little bit about Loudoun County, it's 517 square miles. It's got seven incorporated towns, 13 villages, and 285,000 residents. I mention that because it's got an interesting statistic, and that is that during this past decade, for several years, it was the fastest-growing county or fastest-growing locality in the United States. We're no longer that. Hoorah. We're not even in the top 10 anymore. So the economy took care of that one. A very techie community. And I mentioned this just as a kind of a backdrop as to what we deal with teleworking. 10% of, we have 90%, I'm sorry, penetration of broadband in the community. There's a lot of high-tech businesses in the community, both large and small. I don't know if you just saw the announcement about Raytheon moving out there with over 3,000 employees. Many big and some really large data centers. Sometimes you don't even know what they are as you go by them. And actually, you've got Dulles and you've got FEMA on Mount Weather and a lot of federal agencies here and there. That's kind of the busy part of it. The western two-thirds of the county is rather rural. It is pockmarked with five-acre estates, I guess you call them mini-estates, very large estates, horse farms, vineyards, trying to grow the rural agricultural type business out there. So it's very different. And that part, or that two-thirds of the land mass, I would say it's underserved by broadband. So it's very different. You got 90% overall, but you got a huge two-thirds area that's underserved. When you look at the county government, Gil was nice enough to mention the award that we received from the Center for Digital Government. It is a techie government. The employees like technology. The board of the elected boards have liked technology. They've invested in technology. Back in the late 90s, that board made an effort to fund a emphasis on making a virtual government. You know, let's do as much business as we can through the website. 2007, Computer World did a study. We didn't even know they were doing it. They hired a company to do a study and rank all locality websites. And they never told us. We happened to read it in Computer World. They ranked Loudoun County's as one of the top 14 in the country among county governments, which was, you know, very nice. But I think that was kind of proof of the interest in technology. Numerous awards for teleworking. We've got an excellent program out there. Again, a little bit of backdrop. The telework program really began in 96, believe it or not, when myself and the head of Department of Mental Health and a few people from the Human Resources Office sat down and wrote a telework policy into the HR policies. I had one teleworker, and they had a handful of teleworkers, and mental health used to have three or four laptops, and they'd pass them around among a dozen people, and they'd bring them back in the office, and they'd write down the diskette or disk, and they'd insert them in another machine. I mean, it was really crude and basic. But we launched a telework program. In 2005, the county administrator, I won't say he relaunched it, he reemphasized it and basically told the county department heads, you need to be doing this. I'm going to tell you flat out, and I can give you a long story about it, but that doesn't work just to say, tell everybody do it. It never really took off until we really relaunched it, and that's when we hired a telework coordinator, who happens to be sitting in the room, by the way. Diane, you're right over there. So did an excellent job, and that's really what kicked off our telework program as it is today. Today, 20% of the county workforce, if you exclude the public safety workers out of it, 20% telework. In numbers, that's 440, and might not seem like a lot, perhaps, compared to maybe some of the other agencies. But the interesting thing about a county government is that it's really diverse. And you heard my background. I came over from the public schools. And in IT and the public schools, a lot of it's cookie cutter. You know, what you do for one high school, you do for another high school, you do for another high school. Same thing to the middle school, same thing to the elementaries. The thing that struck me when I came to the county government, and it's what we deal with teleworking, is the diversity of it. If you go to each of the 28 departments in Loudoun County government, you're going to find they all have a different mission. They all have a different culture about them. They all have different types of employees, different types of interests. Some of them are very college-educated backgrounds, most of them. Some of them are not. You go to the Department of Fire and Rescue Services, which is kind of like a paramilitary type organization, and you compare that up against our library services, totally different. And the information systems they use are totally different. The technologies that they're built on are totally different. Some of them are client-server. Some of them are all green screen mainframe. Some of them are browser-based. But that diversity is what we had to deal with these 440 people. And we think we got it down pretty good. We got it down for those the way it's working right now, that 20% is working on cruise control. And I got to thank Diane and a lot of hard workers in throughout the IT department that made it work that way. Just a couple more statistics, and then I'll sit down and let somebody else talk here. 45% of the teleworkers live outside the county. Another part of the diversity that we deal with, though, is 21% live out of state. And the minute you go west of Loudoun County, you over to Blue Ridge Mountain, where a lot of these people live, you're getting into pretty rural areas. You're getting out in Winchester. You're getting up in West Virginia. You're going up north, Maryland, Pennsylvania. We deal with all kinds of broadband with those people, everything from satellite to DSL. No dial-up. That doesn't work. But satellite, DSL, cable, Fios, we're dealing with it all. So, again, it's the diversity. Does it pay off? Yeah, and I'll sit down here. Back in 2007, and I think this is the number that shows that it really does something for the organization, the overall turnover rate among county employees was 13%. The teleworkers, it was 3%. 20% of them share space, and the average teleworker is off the road 9.2 hours that they spent on the road previously. That's each month. So I'll sit down and
Great. Thank you.
All right, as we go through this, the rest of the panel, I want you to be thinking about the points that Gene made. And the key word we heard was diversity, number of departments, number of agencies, number of cultures, number of different telecommunication systems, and so on. That's the situation that everybody in the room faces, even if you've got tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of employees, and we'll come back and talk about how we work through that. Our next presenter is Jack Jones. Jack is the Chief Information Officer for the National Institutes of Health. NIH CIO's office provides IT strategic planning to the leadership and the Institute Center directors. He is also involved in IT governance at NIH and responsible for coordinating NIH IT with other Health and Human Services operating divisions and with other federal agencies. He was appointed to serve as CIO of National Institutes of Health in June of 2008. He joined NIH in 2001 as the Chief IT Architect. And previously, he was with Sandia National Laboratories. Last position there was Director of Information Processes. Jack attended Case Western Reserve University as an undergraduate and graduated first in his class, and then went on to continue his education at Stanford and received the master's and PhD degrees in aeronautical engineering. His graduate education was interrupted with 4 years of service in the Navy, where he served as a naval aviator, and then shifted his career focus from aviation to computing, and began to work on employing standards in computer-aided design and manufacturing, and received an award from the National Institute of Standards and Technology for being the first commercial use of the initial graphics exchange specifications. One of Jack's goals at NIH has been to ensure that information technology is a match to the business needs and processes that it supports. His efforts have brought together disparate communities, from physician scientists to accountants and technologists, and the results include the development of business process and conceptual data models for grants awards and management, and acceptance of business process modeling as a required part of application development. And in his spare time, Jack pursues aviation when and if he can, although I suspect he did not fly in here today. Please welcome Jack Jones.
My wife wouldn't let me fly. It costs too much. Makes me walk a lot. Let's see. I'd start by telling you a little bit about NIH, in case you don't know. It has about 14 or 18,000 employees and another 14,000 contractors that work there. The institute is not singular. It's plural. There are 27 institutes and centers within NIH, each of which is independently funded by the Congress and has some focus in basic research or illness and disease. And so the NIH is actually, it's several small communities, about 27 of them. Sometimes we say 50, but lots of small communities. I went there in the beginning because it looked to me, from the IT perspective, a lot like the Internet and microcosm. And while lots of people are pretty sure that we're all going to get organized pretty soon, if you think about what's actually affected us over the last 20 years, it's been the realization that the Internet is there and that more happens in the, quote, disorganized Internet than usually happens in a lot of places that are trying to be organized. So that's sort of background. I thought I'd start today with where we began in telework. Our initial pilot was in 2001. Being an organization that sponsors grants, we also went out and got one to help with this, and you can see who gave us that grant. And it started with 50 people in four of the institutes. That's grown over time. Today we have 3,300 official teleworkers who spend at least one day a week working from some other location. And this may not seem like very much, but we'll get to the reason for that in the end. Go to the next slide. Can we back up one? I missed one. Never mind. Go to this one. We've done a fair amount of work in policy in trying to think about what it takes to be a teleworker. Mostly, in the end, we've only focused on one thing, and that is that you be able to produce satisfactory output in your job while you're teleworking. And so over time, the criteria have become relaxed to the point where can you get a good performance review is the primary measure for whether you can telework or not. We've tried to characterize those things as thinking about portability and do you have clear work products that you're supposed to produce. In the end, those things didn't help us all that much, and so largely they've disappeared. In support of this, we've done a fair amount of work in hardware and software. We've put in a number of ways to access our systems depending on what sort of work you're doing. There's a standard VPN that I'll talk about a little bit more that's secure and has a fair number of capabilities. We, of course, have web email, so you can look at that. We have lots of collaboration sites. SharePoint gets the most of it, but we have, I think it's at the moment, a BEA portal that also has a lot of that, and a fair amount of remote desktop work so that, in fact, information doesn't actually have to leave our site. There's a lot of implications for telework involving security, and I'm sure we'll hear more about them, so I won't try to hit all of them at the moment. In the hardware world, the biggest difficulty we've had, and we're still waiting for a lot of this, is two-factor authentication. For our most sensitive things, we put that in with RSA tokens that are produced one-time passwords, and we're waiting for the complete rollout of the HSPD-12 badges as the way we're actually going to do this. Let's go on. You can see we keep plots throughout the month of who's using our VPN concentrators. You can see the peaks, and biggest peaks seem to occur on Saturdays, actually, which we'll talk about a little bit more, but every day there's a peak, and lunch, and then evening times. And we've produced enough concentrators to support 10,000 people. You may say, why 10,000 people with only 3,300 teleworkers? And I would say that we're going to have many people who work remotely who aren't actually teleworkers. It's part of the change to make things happen 24 hours a day. Let's go to the next slide. Why do we do this? I think our number one reason is the first one, which is it helps us recruit people and retain them. It's an attractive feature to not have to drive or into the office. And we're seeing more and more people ask us about this in their interviews, is what are their options for doing that. We live in Bethesda, and there's not enough parking space, so we're happy not to see that. And we've also gotten to the point where we have enough people who don't come in regularly that we have significant amounts of hotel space so that we've not had to expand our floor space requirements very much. In the federal government, there are some drivers for this in terms of public law and policy of our parent organizations. We actually think we get more hours of work out of people. And the last one is this is, for us, a significant emergency preparedness factor. There was a while ago, you may recall, a lot of talk about pandemic flu and how people are going to work through that. NIH did a fair amount of planning for how we would respond. Mostly what we think we're going to do if there's a pandemic flu is do research on how to produce a vaccine and how to treat what people who have it. But people need to be working, and at the same time, they're going to want to be taking care of their families in that situation. And so telework's a major factor in our preparedness for all that. Let's go on to the last slide. I've sort of hinted at this several times. We have way more people who don't work at work than we have official teleworkers. And I would probably suggest that if you're thinking about this purely in terms of telework, think about mobility. I have 3,300 teleworkers, but I have 9,000 people carrying BlackBerries or iPhones and doing work off those. I have a whole bunch of people, and the reason Saturday is the biggest day of workload, so a lot of people who need to do more than their 8 hours a day worth of work, or at least are willing to, and on Saturday mornings they can do it without coming into work. So they're not on telework policies. They're merely working wherever they happen to be. Last week I had a request for, so how am I going to get my email while I'm on the cruise ship? And two answers. One is take your BlackBerry with you, because it turns out the cruise ship supports cell phones and the data transmission is not charged on the ship, so you can get free BlackBerry service on your at least some of the cruise lines. And every cruise line now has a satellite dish on top. The rates are exorbitant, but you can be working from your cruise ship. And so my requests are largely about this issue of how do I be mobile, not how do I telework. And many more people, I would say I probably have in total something on the order of 20,000 people who work sometime not at their desk. And that's the bigger problem for me than telework. Things that are problems associated with this is how do you deal with the devices that you don't control? What do you do with people's home computers? What do you do when they want to get information from the internet cafe they're at in Italy because they're at a conference there that's talking about something? And then the other computers that are on the networks they have at home, because now most of my people have a network at home. They don't just have one computer. And how do you work the funding out for this? Is everybody wants it, and everybody's sure somebody else should pay for it, because nobody likes to pay for the infrastructure. So with that,
great. Thank you. John.
So there is probably the best example I've heard in a long time about two things. One is the morphing of telework into mobility. And those of you who have known me over the years know that I've said many times that my fondest dream is that we'd stop using the word telework, that it's just about work that happens to be done wherever you are. And what Jack described here, the most fascinating thing, is that ratio, that he's got capacity for three times as many remote connections as he does have formal teleworkers. And I'd argue that all of your agencies need to be in that range, not only because of the more general kind of virtual work or mobile work, but also in terms of COOP and preparedness issues. Because on any given day, if a lot of people can't get to the office, they're going to want to connect, and you can't, if you base your infrastructure just on the teleworkers, you're never going to be able to satisfy them. And on the last point about the cruise ships, again, those of you who know me know that I will be fascinated with that technology, and also that I have to raise the question about just go lie on the deck chair, you know, and the hell with the email, but to each their own. Okay, let's move on now to our third presenter, Tom Boyce, who is a deputy CIO and director of Office of Information Systems at the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. In this position, Tom has oversight responsibilities of the agency, information technology, and information management programs with a $60-plus million-a-year budget. He began his career in private industry as a computer system engineer and joined the federal government in 1986. Since that time, he's had a series of IT management positions in multiple agencies and has set up project management offices in those agencies. Just before joining NRC, Tom managed one of the largest grants management systems in the federal government for the Electronic Research Administration Program at the National Institutes of Health, which is used to manage a $30 billion with a B dollar a year program in grants payments. Tom's written about practical applications of project management practices for trade journals and speaks frequently on IT governance, IT infrastructure management, and program management. He received his Bachelor of Science in Information Systems Management from the University of Maryland, University College in College Park, and is a senior fellow on the Council for Excellence in Government. And when you see him later on, please pat him on the back or shake his hand, because today is Tom's birthday. Yeah. Tom, come on up. Good morning. I know I didn't put the last part in my resume that I gave you, but they found that anyways. Before I get started, I want to thank Sandy Johnson of our HR department. She's provided me with the background and statistics, because like Gil said, I'm usually up here talking about something else, program management or IT governance, but we're here today for telework. I'm part of an executive steering committee at NRC that it's called the Work-Life Steering Committee, and telework's part of that and an important part of that, but we're trying to look at all aspects to make NRC a more flexible employer, and telework's just part of that. We have a pilot ongoing right now where we're looking at extending the workday from 5 to 11 so we don't send people at home and sort of assume they have to dial in to get that job done, because we all know our jobs drive us to 9 and 10-hour days sometime, but we want to have this pilot such that you can have a window in the middle of the day where you're off taking care of those family duties, whatever they may be, cooking dinner, soccer practice, whatever, and then either come back to the office or telework from home. Now, right now that's just in a pilot mode, but it just speaks to the whole we're trying to address those work-life balance issues. And I would have told the person on the cruise, I may have an answer for you, but it's no. We don't want you taking the BlackBerry. NRC's criteria, who's eligible for to be a teleworker, is pretty much standard across the government. It's much like NIH's, so I'm not going to dwell on that. We do have some staff with unique challenges due to the nature of the classified material they work with, and while we've examined ways to let them work at home, we haven't found an easy answer yet for security reasons. Part of that's high-level outside of NRC regulations that deal with the materials. Like many people, we call our program FlexiPlace, or a fixed schedule FlexiPlace. We do have two nuances that might be worth mentioning. We formally recognize what we call project-based or impromptu telework, where on an ad hoc basis, somebody can work from hours to days on a telework. We have a laptop loaner program that we've instituted so they can come get a secure laptop to connect into the NRC network. And we also have a formally recognized hardship or health program where if you have some health need where you're immobile and can't go into work, you can telework on a limited basis. Those are usually approved for up to 6 months at a time. I've only been with NRC since last February. As you heard, Jack and I were colleagues at NIH. So I don't have the corporate memory for when the telework program started, but in preparing for today, I was searching through the archives, as it were, on our network, and we have memos going back to 1993, especially on the hardship and health-related issues of we need to have a formal recognition that this is an okay thing to do, people can telework. So what does an NRC teleworker need? We currently supply Outlook webmail for people on travel and for use from home, but as far as a dedicated teleworker, we supply two-factor authentication through PKI certificates. We're migrating those people over as this summer, as a matter of fact. We're rolling out HSPD-12 for first logical access, but that same PKI certificate will be loaded on their computer for access into our SSL-based Citrix access. We currently have around 4,000 employees in NRC, 2,300 of which have PKI certificates. And don't get excited about the 2,300 number. Like Jack, we only have around 440 that actually telework on a somewhere near a full-time basis. But we have a lot more users like myself that telework in on a regular basis. I don't think a week goes by when I haven't used my Citrix access to get into work and get something done. So our telework percentage is hovering around 11%. One of our challenges is we don't have timekeeping codes that differentiate between in-the-office hours and telework hours, so it's hard to get a return on investment or track those people that are doing it on a part-time basis. And there are limitations. Not all our corporate applications are currently Citrix-friendly. I'm sure Gene Troxell had, you know, all the applications he mentioned. There's some challenges there delivering all those up
in a remote environment in a secure manner. We're working on that. We're trying to, A, expand our Citrix farm, and B, deliver all our applications up. If people go on the road, we supply them with a laptop with an air card. We don't want them plugging into the wireless network at the local coffee house. We want it going over a secure backbone as much as possible. We try to control that environment. And I would agree with Jack that telework is an important part of our retention and recruitment for people. There was an article in the Post, and I meant to clip it and bring it in, 2 or 3 weeks ago about in this environment where there's lots of layoffs, some of the employers are going, we don't need to worry about telework anymore because the market's competitive. I don't need to dangle it out there. I would argue it's just the opposite. I want to get the best, brightest, and most eager people to work, and if I can supply telework to get them to come to NRC instead of somebody else, that's what we need to offer. I think that's a wrong mindset. We do have challenges. I'm going to let my colleagues here talk some more, but one of the things I'd like to see we can talk about, question, formally funding telework and the infrastructure necessary to do it, I think, is a challenge we need to really address. COOP and DR is one of the ways to do that. If we make it part of our disaster recovery plans and telework's an added benefit, I think we can gain some momentum there. But I'd like to hear what the audience thinks, too, so right now I'll turn it over to my colleague here. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Rod, I'm going to be bold and say that I'm at least one person in this room who needs an Tom, I need an explanation of two-factor authentication that I can understand.
Something you have and something you know.
Okay.
Is that simple enough?
A card and a my child's third middle name or something like that.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, thank you. 2 points to note there. Tom mentioned that his program is referred to as FlexiPlace. I would venture to say there is nobody else in the room here who may remember the fact that a gentleman named Frank Schiff, who worked for the National Bureau of Economic Research, wrote an op-ed piece for the Washington Post in 1974, pre-personal computers, pre-internet, pre-everything, in which he promoted the idea of FlexiPlace, as he called it, for the federal government. It's always great to see how things come back in full cycle. The other point I want to make note of is Tom's reference to the Washington Post article, which I know we'll talk about later. The myopia of saying that just because the unemployment rate is unfortunately bumping up to double digits that we don't have to worry about being smart talent managers as employers. Craziest thing in the world, there was an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal last week from a manager who said, hiring freezes today are stupid, because there has never been a better talent pool of top-notch people who are available, not because they're bad employees, but because they lost their jobs, who can be obtained now at a much lower cost than you ever could get them before. So this is a time for some upside-down thinking. Don't think about that people should be thankful to work for you. You should be on your knees begging them, if you will, and this is a great time to hire the best and the brightest. Our last panelist is Rod Turk, who is the Director of IT Security Management Group and Chief Information Security Officer at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office in the Department of Commerce. He is in the forefront of the government's efforts on cybersecurity. He manages and oversees PTO's compliance with the Federal Information Security Management Act, or FISMA, and the implementation of IT security best practices. His first position in the senior executive service was with the Transportation Security Administration, where he began in September of 2004. And he had a number of roles at agencies such as Defense Logistics Agencies, Office of Justice Programs in the Department of Justice, the TSA, and he was a Deputy Assistant Administrator for Information Technology and the Assistant Administrator for the Office of Transportation Vetting and Credentialing. His business card was this long at that time. Rod is a retired Navy Supply Corps captain. He has an MBA from Temple University and a bachelor's degree from the University of Wisconsin. Please welcome Rod, and again, thank you for stepping in at the last minute to join our panel.
Listening to my bio, you'd think I'd have trouble, I'd had trouble holding a job or something like that. Well, first of all, I want to send my regrets from John Owens. He wishes he could be here, but unfortunately he had something come up and was not able to attend. Also, I'd like to mention, Gene, that the Dulles Airport was supposed to be in Fairfax County. In fact, right on top of my house in Burke, Virginia. So just want to make sure you knew that. Jack, it's nice to have a Navy aviator on the panel, a fellow Navy guy. And happy birthday, Tom. I appreciate that. I took a look at the title today for this panel, and it says, Telework Dividends Getting Behind the Numbers. So as I considered that, I thought that, you know, maybe it would be a good idea to give some numbers so that we can then maybe talk about what those numbers mean and something about those numbers. So if you'll bear with me, I want to give you some statistics from the Patent and Trademark Office as to where we're at as it relates to teleworking. Right now, the current number of teleworkers at Patent and Trademark Office, 4,719. The current eligible positions, 5,740, which leads us with a percentage of positions that are eligible of nearly 59%. The eligible positions that are teleworking, agency-wide, 82.21%. The number of patent teleworkers, 3,853. Percent of eligible positions that are teleworking, 89.63. Total number of trademark teleworkers, 441. And the percent of eligible trademark positions that are teleworking, 84.64. The number of patent positions, and this is kind of a staggering number to me, of patent examiners who are working 4 days a week, 1,556, and the number of trademark positions, teleworking 4 days a week, 316. Now, there's two things about our telework program that I'm impressed with. As mentioned, I'm the Chief Information Security Officer, so I'm not going to belabor you with all the security things that we're doing for teleworking, but there are two things that I did want to mention. And the first is that the benefits that we have to teleworking are staggering for us at the Patent and Trademark Office. We have had significant improvements or significant these initiatives that have allowed us to forego spaces, forego having people come to our campus. We have been able to increase our workforce without increasing our real estate costs or our real estate footprint over at by the King Street Metro. And this has driven significant cost savings in the neighborhood of about $11 million for us. We've also been able to use the system for training and been able to train our workforce through the teleworking presence. It also, as mentioned before by a couple of the other panelists, that it offers some COOP, continuity of operations benefits. And through these hoteling programs for both patents and trademarks, we've been able to improve the productivity of our workforce, we believe, by about 10%. So the benefits, the bottom line to this, are the benefits that we've seen in the telework program have been significant for the Patent and Trademark Office. Now, there is a second piece that I'm impressed with as well, and that is something, Tom, I think that you'll probably appreciate as a former program management officer. I've been impressed with the way that this telework program has been rolled out at the Patent and Trademark Office. And what I mean by that is that we've treated this as a project with logical goals to begin with, a charting of a course from those goals and from those requirements to a logical conclusion. And the benefits that you've noted here and the success that we've had, I think, are a testament to the ability of the Patent and Trademark team to be able to field this technology. What I mean by project management, developing the requirements, developing those requirements, getting buy-in from all of the stakeholders within the organization, demonstrating the need to those stakeholders, developing a design which we can then implement to be able to move forward with the program. And then at the end of the program, a lot of the things that normally are not completed in a project are those things at the end of the development of an IT project, such as training, such as measuring of the metrics to see if whether or not you've been successful. I've been impressed with our program to indicate that those things have been completed. We have an extensive training program. We train our people very, very detailed in what they're supposed to be doing to be successful as a teleworker. And then at the end of the day, you heard the benefits. We measure to see whether or not that return on investment has been achieved by the Patent and Trademark Office. And I've been impressed by that, and I think that we've been very successful. We at the Patent and Trademark Office, though, despite the fact that we have been successful, we're not stopping. We hire a significant number of new employees. We are offering telework opportunities for those employees as well, and as we continue to grow, we're going to continue to use that project-based paradigm so that we can then continue to size our systems and make those systems available to the new people who are coming on to telework here at the Patent and Trademark Office. So that's all I have this morning. It's a pleasure to be here, and I think Gil's got some questions for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm actually going to begin with Rod's point that he mentioned a couple times about training. Two questions for you, then I'll ask others to jump in. If I heard you right, you said you're using the telework system or infrastructure for delivering training, and you're also made quite a bit of investment in training for the teleworkers and their managers. Can you talk about both of those?
I think there's two points to that. First of all, we have a very detailed training module that we use and we put our teleworkers through a training process so that they know what their expectations are. And for a chief information security officer, that's really important, because we want our employees who are going to telework to understand how they're supposed to use that product so that they can be successful, first of all. But second of all, the front line of IT security is really the individual employee. 40%, if I read the trade journals correctly, of all IT kind of security-related incidents fall right directly on an individual, one employee doing something that they shouldn't be doing. So we want to make sure they understand what those security processes are. And the Internet is a tool like any other tool. We want to make sure that tool is used properly so that it's secure and that they can do their job. The second point is that we have initiated some projects at the Patent and Trademark Office where we are using collaboration amongst examiners to be able to help with their daily workload. So things that have been mentioned before, like SharePoint and some other tools that allow collaboration between examiners so that when something comes up in their work process that may be a sticking point for that particular examiner, they can go back to a mentor, they can go back to other people who have had that that issue, and be able collaboratively as a teleworker to be able to learn how to work through that process within their workplace. One of the things in teleworking, when you're at home and you're by yourself, being able to link up with colleagues to be able to work through some of those stickier points in your job performance, we think that we're trying to provide those collaborative tools so that can happen from a telework instance.
Great, thank you. Any of the others panelists want to comment on what you're doing with training in your organization, the investments you've made in training, or that you'd like to make and haven't been able to?
We're doing more and more web-based training all the time, mm-hmm. and so more of the thing is delivered independent of location. Very little classroom training is left, and so it makes it possible for the teleworkers to be trained. I wouldn't say we are working on at the moment a particular teleworking training module. Not so much of what they're doing, but what they could do that they're not doing.
Just think, with the end of classroom training, all those hundreds of donuts going uneaten.
It's part of tragic. It's part of our improving the nation's health plan.
Yeah, that's right, the health plan, right. I want to turn to Gene now and reflect on something that he said that actually ties in with what Max Steyer said before. Max said in his presentation, legislation is the starting pistol, not the race. In your comments, Gene, you talked about when I think the county executive in 2005 sort of relaunched this and kind of mandated it. One of the things that you said was that telling everybody to do it just doesn't cut it. So I want to talk some more about that, the relationship between policy and practice and how one does or doesn't lead to the other.
Yeah, that was interesting to watch that play out. And I can tell you that the biggest obstacle, and you probably already know this, to teleworking is the manager and the supervisor. The employees want to do it. The manager and the supervisor doesn't want to let the employees do it. And the message being delivered to the managers and the supervisors was to do it. Well, that was the end of the message. Occasionally, we kind of joke about this, occasionally we'd have a teleworker knock on the door of IT and said, hey, my department head said I could do this. And they would come in, and we've got these diversity, you know, these 100 different information systems. And we make jokes about it. We said we used to bring them into the conference room and gather a group of people around. You know, the security person would be there, the applications guy would be there, the analyst that knew with the systems that he wanted to use, the office automation person would come in. And we used to joke about it. We'd put them in the chair. We used to say we'd turn on the spotlight and sweat them. You know, what do you want to do, and how do you want to do it? And we'd have to figure this out. That just wasn't going to work either. There was no procedures in place. All there was an old 1996 policy. And the point I'm trying to make out of that, you really need to get a heads-down person to come in and organize it. It starts with the policies. It start, and then, you know, you end up with the procedures. Right now, we have it down to the point where if somebody wants to telework, they can discuss it with their supervisor and the department head. We have it all online. The form to request teleworking is up there. The applications that they want to select, they can pick off. It automatically flows to the department head for approval. It ultimately comes to us. When we get through with it, enabling the rights to do what the person wants to do, the last thing he gets is an email. And it goes back to training. Because of our diversity, what we've found is that we do have to talk and meet with those people before we send them home with that laptop. And by the way, it has to be a county laptop. You can't use your own equipment. And what we do is we bring them over, and they sit down on a one-on-one meeting with one of our IT people, and it's usually the same guy. He's one of the network people. And they can't leave that room and go home to telework until they show that they know how to use the VPN, they know how to use that laptop to launch their applications, that we know that they got all the software on that thing that's going to make it work. Because when they go out the door, they're on their own. If they call the help desk and they say, I can't get on my home network or something, we tell them, call your ISP. We're not going to help them. We're not making service calls to homes.
Great. Thank you. Let me open up the audience now. If you have a question for a particular panelist, please say so. If it's a general one, let us know. The shorter the questions, the more we can handle. Questions out here. And we have microphones coming around. Got two in the front here. Oh, one in the back. Go ahead.
If we could just actually go a little bit further with what was just said, the person from Loudoun County seem to, I don't know, be able to direct the use of telework perhaps a little bit more than federal agencies. The people working with federal agencies, what were you able to do to address some of these same problems, the ideas that the managers didn't want it or the supervisors didn't want it?
One of the things that we did that opened this up a lot was during the disaster recovery exercises, we actually created test days where we had everybody stay home and work from home, both to get the experience, find out that their laptops were, in fact, appropriately configured, and also to convince their management that, in fact, this could happen. And that had a pretty beneficial effect in addition to the test and demonstration that we could do it. There was lots of learning that went on those days.
I don't think that there's a cookie-cutter approach to that, and the reason I say that is that you really need to take a look at the strategic intent of your organization. What kind of work do you do? What is the workflow? What is the processes? What are the processes that you have at your organization? Just to give you an example, at the Patent and Trademark Office, for patent examiners and trademark examiners, that's a fairly individualistic work process. Mm-hmm. And whether you're doing it on campus or doing it at home, as long as the results are the same, it really doesn't, for our purposes, doesn't make much difference. Now, if you are in an environment where more collaboration, more meetings, more discussion is required, I think that's what you have to decide how you want to do that. It really boils down to the strategic intent of the organization. And if your strategic intent is such that you can make telework work and then flow the budget from that in strategic intent, I think that's where you have to go.
Right. As we heard from all the presentations, it's a matter of the culture, the task mix, all of those things that are different. No manager can be bludgeoned into accepting telework for a long time. That's the key thing. Questions front. Yes.
Hi, my name is Renee, and I'm from NIH. I hear all of you all talking about training and how training is a big aspect of telework. And I hear you talk about the web-based training, but what about the classroom training for the managers? Because what I've experienced at the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases is that a lot of managers are resistant because they, you know, they want to hear from other managers what they're doing and how they're working through problems. But if they're doing it online, there's not much of a collaboration with other managers to overcome the barriers that they're facing. Great. So what is your
great
thoughts
question.
On that?
Great question.
Sure. Well, we recognize that. I have people working on the aspects of first of all, beyond telework, the sort of presence on the on an electronic environment. We've certainly in our business piece, one of the things that's working that's now being extended is we do a lot of peer review of our grant applications with people from across the country. And in trying to improve that aspect of our business, we spent a lot of time on first video conferencing, desktop video conferencing, various ways to bring people remote presence to the situation. And out of that, we're beginning to learn different situations require different elements in presence. And sometimes just video and voice helps. Sometimes you need to see computer screens. The place that I think you're talking about is the side conversations that go on in relation to either the main purpose of the meeting or actually unrelated to the main purpose of the meeting. So we now have some experimental things that actually allow participants to have side conversations, either through IM on the side of the meeting or to actually open another voice channel to talk to each other. Probably the people who get that last will be the managers because...
Right, because they're managers.
Because they're managers, you know, and they're busy talking to each other all the time.
The current phrase is blended learning, right? I mean, online training, as good as it is, and there's some great online training for telework and mobile work out there, especially for the managers, I don't think it's adequate. I think it gets them started. There has to be some kind of either computer-mediated or face-to-face interaction. And it's also helpful, and you addressed this, the managers, the novice reluctant manager needs to hear the success stories, not from the HR person, not from guys like this, but from the fellow in-the-weeds manager. And that's where a lot of programs fail because they don't have the credibility of that peer kind of support. There was another question here.
If I might, we do have a management module, and it is in person that we use at the Patent and Trademark Office, and it's tailored to the individual office because each office has different opportunities, different challenges on how to do telework. Mm-hmm. So we use that as well.
And if I could just add, we do have classroom training also, and it's for the teleworker and the supervisor. One thing I think. To be honest with you, I think should have been done is I think that every department head should have been forced to go through the training. We did not do that.
Ours was.
Tom, do you have a comment?
I had to take it 6 weeks ago.
Just to say I concur with the observations. I said I was on a work-life steering committee, which is at NRC at a high level. So management at the senior levels gets it and wants to get telework in place, but you see the reluctance at the middle manager level. And what I would say is if you train them correctly, they're going to realize that telework makes them a better manager because they're going to be that much more aware of what the employees are working on and what the expected outcomes are, which when somebody comes to me with a reluctance, so-and-so asked to be put on a telework schedule, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to manage them. I walk them through, no, it works fine. I have one of my senior-level people that teleworks 3 days a week. I don't have any problems finding her, getting work output from her, because we have casual conversations about what are you doing this week and when am I going to see whatever it is.
Great. Okay, come on, a question in the front. Yes, please.
Do you consider yourself bandwidth constrained?
Do you consider yourself for anybody?
Anyone.
I can say a couple things. Bandwidth is not an issue right now, but we are improving our network. One of the things that we were constrained with is we were tied to Microsoft operating systems, actually Microsoft XP Pro, and that has gotten to be a constraint for us because we're finding as we are using, allowing some user-furnished equipment out there, and so we have different people on different operating systems that we have to look at. We do have a capital improvement program to allow us to get the infrastructure to be able to get those different operating systems. Mm-hmm.
Great point. There was a question in the back corner there, please. Yep, please come on.
Hi, Allison Tanner with Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and my question is for any of the panelists who might be able to answer. One of the issues that we faced in increasing our participation in telework is the initial cost of equipping teleworkers with a laptop in addition to maintaining desktops in the office. So we've recently implemented a requirement that teleworkers, those who telework at least 2 days per pay period or 20% of their work schedule, they're also agreeing to go to a single device model. So they give up their desktop at work, they get a laptop and a docking station in lieu of that, and so they have to bring their laptop in each time they come into the office. So I was just wondering if any of your organizations have tried something like that, or if you're doing something like that, and what problems, if any, are you encountering?
Great. You want to take that?
We're currently at a ratio of 1.4 devices, laptop, desktop, to one employee, and I want to get that down to closer to one. And one of our challenges is all the security issues right now. If you use a laptop in the office, you're not allowed to bring that home based on security policy and plug it into the home network and then bring it back into the office. Once it goes home and you use it outside of our environment, it stays home. Now, we're working to come up with a security model where we can avoid that and make it so you can go back and forth. But until we're there, that's where we're stuck. I was talking to Rod offline about how are they meeting their challenges, and I may want to follow up with him later because I don't believe you have that problem, do you?
Well, I mean, it's always a problem. Security is always a problem. I lose 2 or 3 hours of sleep every night over security problems. But not related to telework, I must say. The decision on security is really a risk-based decision. Mm-hmm. What is it that your organization, what kind of data, what kind of work processes do you have at your organization, and what are you going to allow that person to manipulate in terms of data and workflow at home? So you have to look at that and see what that risk is. For the Patent and Trademark Office, it's personally identifiable information and certain business-sensitive patents up to the 18-month point of publishing. So what we do is we require two-factor authentication. We require a laptop that basically the laptop is a commodity. The teleworker is not allowed to, or by policy, not allowed to save work to the laptop. It's saved back at a server back at the Patent and Trademark Office. And each of those laptops have safe boot on it. Now, you ask me, why do I have to put safe boot with full hard disk encryption on a laptop that supposedly has nothing saved on it? Well, we all know the issues with laptops and how laptops sometimes get lost or sometimes get stolen, and it's an embarrassment to the organization. It's just better to have the laptop safe booted with full disk encryption so if something happens to it, nobody can get into it. From a user-furnished equipment standpoint, we believe that the risk is acceptable to be able to put some kind of secure virtual system on that user-furnished equipment, which will then not allow any storage of any kind of government information on that home equipment. We also require them, before they join the program, to have the antivirus, spam guard, the firewalls enabled, up-to-date patching, all of those kinds of things on their home computer. And if they decide that they don't want to go through that process, then I'm sorry, you can't use your home computer. And we will check before we actually allow that connection back through an encrypted SSL VPN connection back into their desktop, remote desktop processing, back to their desktop at the Patent and Trademark Office.
Okay, so on that note, I'm afraid I need to cut it off so we can keep the program going. You'll be able to catch up with these gentlemen during the rest of the day, I just want to remind you to reach into your packets and take out the evaluation form for session one, fill it out, and put it in those white boxes outside. There are extra forms available from the Telework Exchange staff. We're going to take a 30-minute break now. Please go back to the exhibit area, get another cup of coffee, and then we'll resume back here at 11:45 sharp with our second session, Establishing a Balanced Telework Portfolio. Please join me in thanking Gene, Tom, Jack, and Rod for a great session.
Most of our stuff isn't.
Yeah, ours isn't perfect either.
It's like 90% not. So
we do just the opposite.